First of all, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy life to join us for this teleconference call. We greatly appreciate it.
Yes, well, I'm happy to be here, too. I'm very excited about this subject matter and what I've got to say here.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, let me give you a quick introduction. So Kate currently lives and practices in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and she's been in homeopathic practice since 1994. She's done over 1,900 hours in homeopathic and clinical education and has studied with international masters from all over the world. She focuses particularly on men, women, children, all kinds of health concerns from infancy through life. And she also served as the vice president of the North American Society of Homeopaths from 2005 through 2008. She also, in the fall of 2000, represented NASH at the inaugural International Council of Homeopaths in Heidelberg, Germany. Maybe we can hear a little bit about that conference a little bit later on. In the spring of 2007, Kate published a book called Vaccine, Pre-Prevention and Treatment of Infectious Contagious Disease with Homeopathy, a Manual for Practitioners and Consumers. And I believe this is one of the most comprehensive books we have to date on the subject and how it relates to homeopathy. So we're very excited to have Kate join us and share her expertise on this most important subject. So, Kate, thank you so much again for joining us.
Yeah.
Great. So, Kate, I guess the first question I had for you really is why this topic now? I mean, you know, there's so many different things that are going on in the healthcare field and in homeopathy, and yet you've decided to focus specifically on this subject. So I'm curious, why do you feel this is an important area to put our attention on?
Yeah. So in my own practice, and more people coming, deciding not to vaccinate, and me pointing sort of vaguely at my bookshelf saying, yes, homeopathy, you know, we really can do lots with infectious contagious disease and all these different things. And the people would just kind of look at me with this blank expression on their face and going, well, I'm glad I really trust you, you know, as a practitioner to, okay, fine, I believe you, you know, and not everybody did. So after a time, I thought, you know, there needs to be some kind of book that that I can hand to people or show them. And I did come across a little pamphlet written by a man named Jeffrey Starr, and I bought that a few years ago. It was very helpful, and I would kind of wave that around for my clients, and they liked that book, but it was out of print. So I thought to myself, well, I'll do another book. I'll write a book like this. And as I started writing, I found that the subject matter needed more study than that, you know, 60-page pamphlet offered, and spent 2 years writing this book, which is now it's like 460 pages.
Wow.
And, it's written now because what's coming to the forefront is the mal-effects of vaccine damage. And more educated people are making the choice not to vaccinate, but there isn't a safety net. There isn't something out there that's backing their decision. They're just going on blind faith, which is the beginning, and that's how I started in my quest along this way. But and then on the larger perspective, is it still science has not yet been able to grapple with infectious contagious disease. It seems kind of mind-boggling, actually, and the use of vaccinations is just leading to more and more chronic disease. So this book comes now. I was in a hurry to write it to make sure I was the first one to write it because I know it had been on the minds of many people. So anyways, I'm hopefully ahead of the wave, and it provides a door, an avenue out of the problem that we're just becoming aware of, you know, in the larger realm.
Mm. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, Kate, do people really have a choice on whether they can vaccinate their children or not? I mean, it seems, at least my understanding is that in certain states there are laws that require children to be vaccinated. I guess there are certain exceptions, religious exceptions and other types of things. Can you kind of give us an understanding of what the actual legal situation is relative to vaccinations?
So just as you said, there's different states have different requirements. And I happen to live in Minnesota, which has a bunch of really active activists, and they've lobbied the legislature here to make sure there's not only religious exemption, but philosophical exemption and medical exemption. These exemptions are written on the same side of the form that says you need vaccinations. It also says that these are the exemptions in the same size font. Other states have, you know, I'm not so familiar with their laws, but for the most part, there's medical and religious exemptions. And again, I'm not familiar with what's happening in Canada. Maybe somebody later can give us that information. But yeah, parents can have a choice. There are some states that they not so. It's illegal, and it's under a lot of duress that parents go against the establishment to make that decision. But yeah.
So there are actually some states where it's completely illegal, and there are not even religious or medical exemptions. Is that correct?
You know, I don't have the exact facts on that, but I still read articles of people's children being taken away from parents who haven't vaccinated them.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a problem.
That's amazing. So Kate, how did you get the idea to write this book? And like, what was your intention, your motivation? Who did you write the book for? I mean, did you write it for the homeopathic community, for the general public? Well, can you give us a little bit of an idea of that?
So, you know, as I was saying, I wrote it for the families that were sitting in my office wanting questions. But I also, as I started to write it, knew that I needed to write it for practitioners, too, so that it would be a very useful desktop guide that people could have right there, reference, open the chapter on otitis media, which is not actually infectious contagious disease, but it's a resultant effect of vaccinations, but pneumonia or tuberculosis or herpes or genital warts or anything like that. And in a few minutes, the efficient practitioner can actually find a remedy. But I also wrote it to have, a much deeper study into what is acute disease and the purpose of acute disease and what is the long-term effect of the suppression of acute disease through vaccination programs. And as I started the idea of introducing sexually transmitted diseases, then it opened up a whole other realm of understanding that needed to be addressed, and that was miasms and how miasms transmit through generations. And so it's written for those who want to take a deeper study into what's happening in acute disease and chronic disease.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's also written, again, for those individuals who decide not to vaccinate. They've read a bunch of literature out there, but they still have to deal with their in-laws or their doctors that they go to. It's a tangible reference book that they can take with them and say, well, I've made this decision. You may not agree with me. I may not totally understand it, but here I have this book that supports my decision and is actually showing me a way out, you know, that I have help in this decision.
Hmm. And what about for just the actual professional homeopath? Would there be information in there that would be of value as well?
Totally. Yep. And even more than that, I mean, the largest vision I have for the book, and it says in the addendum, which is on the very last page, is that this book be utilized in the World Health Organization to create mandates for world health programs around, you know, in third world countries where instead of handing out vaccinations, there's homeopathic clinics that are manned by individuals paid for by the local authorities, and homeopathy is, because it's so economically effective, also accessible like that. And actually, just the other day, I was at the post office. I've mailed 4 books off to places in Africa that I got contact information for, homeopathic clinics, and it's really my sort of largest vision of this.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Kate, could you give us an overview of the book, like, you know, the different chapters and what kind of information you actually cover?
Yep. So I start with, well, there is a really nice, what do you call that, foreword by Randall Neustadter, who's well known in this world for his book, The Vaccine Guide. And then it goes into a preface of how the book is put together. And I sort of introduce the problem, what we've just said here, is that if more and more people are deciding not to vaccinate, what then? You know, surely infectious contagious disease will come. It's going to come. It's been in human, it's part of life, you know. But it's asking us to find a different way to navigate it. And so the first chapter then is an overview of basic homeopathic principles. And then we move into looking at fevers, why the immune system needs fevers to develop. And whereas, you know, a few hundred years ago where infectious fevers were killing many people, homeopathy wasn't available. They didn't have antibiotics either. People became very fearful of fevers, and even now you hear people's fear of fevers and looking at the purpose of that. And then we look at the overview of the immune system and the developing immune system and start introducing the ideas of what happens when infants' immune systems are overwhelmed with the onslaught of, well, here in this state, the vaccine schedule between the ages of 0 and 5, they get 62 individual disease shots. So just imagine what that immune system is trying to do.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. and then chapter 4 really opens the door into the basis of homeopathy, which is a look at susceptibility and the miasms and prophylactic care and what we're really doing with homeopathy as we try to address susceptibility. And then chapter 5, I think, is the only place where this is written, other than the Organon of Medicine bits and pieces. Hanuman, you know, I guess they didn't have vaccinations back then, so, but he did talk about similar diseases and dissimilar diseases and possible reactions to disease. And chapter 5 is the overview of vaccinosis, what happens when you get a commingling of diseases and how you understand a case in front of you through the case-taking process of how all these layer upon layer of injected diseases, whether or not they've imprinted the immune system, you get a resultant, like partially expressed disease presentation, or is it awakening of sort of a latent miasmatic condition of the individual. And so it's really a comprehensive, you know, untangling of this clinical picture that we see in children these days of vaccine injury. And then the book kind of breaks off from the philosophical chapters and go through all the diseases, the childhood diseases that are vaccinated against. We've got also rabies and some bioterrorism diseases and influenza, mono, and then again the sexually transmitted diseases and many tropical diseases, too, yellow fever, dengue, malaria, cholera, etc. And a few little appendixes at the end. And each chapter has a comprehensive description of the disease and a look at vaccinations and some of the common side effects of the vaccinations. And then there's a homeopathic treatment and prevention section, which has some historical, you know, these remedies were used in this disease historically, or if there's a genus epidemicus that was determined, and or other prophylactic remedies, and then sort of brief descriptions of remedies, particular symptoms pulled out of those remedies that are particular to those disease manifestations.
So this sounds like there's actually a practical component to the book where a practitioner could actually use it to assist them in actually treating infectious contagious disease.
Yep, exactly.
So, Kate, that's very interesting that you have some information on that. Could you give us a little bit of an understanding of the basis of how homeopathy actually deals with infectious contagious diseases?
Yep. So, let's see here. So, as I was saying, Chapter 4 introduces the subject of susceptibility. In homeopathy, we are able to observe susceptibility through tendencies, through sensitivities in an individual, through character traits, through all of these things. So through case-taking, we're able to understand their susceptibility. And then symptom manifestation of a disease is also based on the susceptibility. So some people get a flu and it will show up as chills and aches and pains, and other people will get a flu and it's a headache and more malaise. And even though it may be the same flu virus per se, but based on the individual's susceptibility, that virus has taken hold in a different way and the body's reaction is that. So accordingly, we look for homeopathic remedies that correspond with the manifestation of the susceptibility or the symptoms, as opposed to the actual diagnostic agent, you know, whatever it is, the bacteria or something like that. And we don't typically see epidemics these days, you know, but we do, like living here in Minnesota, I know during January and February, there's, you know, cases. You know, it's been cold for 3 months, you know, people start getting sick. So there's a susceptibility to sickness or to cold. And what you start to see is that similar remedies are coming up. I do remember that Cosicum and Rumex were particularly useful in my practice this winter, which was exceedingly cold. And both of them ended up with these, you know, these many, many cases, probably 15 or 20, with these Cosicum coughs or Rumex coughs. So then accordingly, there's different remedies that have known affinity to the particular diseases. So like Antimonium crudum is very commonly indicated in cases of chickenpox. So if somebody's been exposed to chickenpox, it's possible to take a dose of Antimonium crudum before any symptoms manifest. Now, in order for the body to become fully liberated from the chickenpox, it does need to go through the disease of a fever and exanthema eruption. But with the support of the remedy, the stages are all sped up. In other illnesses, you can actually subvert the contraction of the illness by giving what we call the homeopathic prophylactic, which has, in past situations, been shown to treat the condition while it's happening. Yeah?
Mm-hmm, I'm here, yeah.
So, also, sort of on the larger picture, we want to look at what's happening with the bell curve of disease. You know, why diseases move through populations, and what is the positive aspect of that disease? So instead of just trying to blindly treat every disease like the disease is a big bad meanie, sometimes disease comes asking us to look for a solution, and those individuals that develop immunity have actually found the solution to the problem. And just based on symptom presentation and treating with homeopathy, we're actually facilitating the evolution of groups and communities to develop immunity and to learn from whatever the disease is.
Interesting.
And hopefully those individuals reading the book will start to glean this information. You know, it's not written so much in a linear fashion, but it's very holographic throughout the book and circular and yeah.
So, Kate, you mentioned earlier the genus or genus epidemicus. I'm curious, I assume you spend some time discussing that whole concept in homeopathy?
Yep. That's in Chapter 4, and again, it's from Hahnemann's work, that usually when an epidemic comes in to a group of people, there's one or two or three remedies that seem to correspond with the majority of the symptoms. And we had looked at this significantly, particularly here in the local Minnesota group of homeopaths, with the onslaught or supposed of the bird flu that was going to come last year or the year before, and looking at cases that had been seen and spotted around the world and the rate of progression of the symptoms, the kinds of symptoms, and all of these things pointing to particular remedies. And knowing that if we had these remedies on our kits, you know, one or other of these remedies would actually serve as a genus epidemicus that could be used prophylactically and treat a majority of the cases. Hmm. Yeah.
So, Kate, you know, obviously you mentioned that Hahnemann was the first really to talk about this idea of the genus or genus epidemicus, and I'm sure you're aware of the scarlet fever outbreak where he used belladonna and found and so and I know that there's a whole historical record of these classical homeopaths using the genus epidemicus. I'm curious, in your researches, did you, because you also mentioned the idea of just giving, you know, like antimonium crudum for chickenpox, even though it's, you know, because historically we know that it's a common remedy for that disease condition. Were you able in your research to ascertain the efficacy of that approach relative to the idea of using the genus epidemicus? Is that something you were able to pick up?
Well, it also is different, too. It relates to epidemic disease or sporadic disease or individual, like collective epidemic. I can't remember all the different terminologies, but there's...
Right.
So the genus epidemicus really refers to epidemics.
Right.
Okay. So where large groups of people are afflicted with the same pathogen, and then you start to see that that population is almost acting like one organism. And so according to the homeopathic principles is that there's a totality of disease, and you treat with one remedy. And that's where you get the genus epidemicus, to treat the whole epidemic, because all these 10,000 people are one person, as if.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Okay, so that's different than an individual case of whooping cough or an individual case of chickenpox. And maybe, concordantly, there are, another 100 cases happening around the nation, but because we don't know where those cases are, you know, we could see that there might be a totality of those individuals, and there may be a genus epidemicus for them, but the tracking of that is a logistical nightmare, right?
Right.
But so then just based on the individual symptom presentation in those situations, you just treat accordingly. And then there's certainly remedies that are more common, like Rustox is another one that's common for chickenpox. So, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And if not, you know, the beginner prescriber could just go down the list and try, okay, that one didn't work. Okay, we try this one. Okay, see, you know.
My question is, you know, because, like, for example, in the 1799 outbreak of scarlet fever, where he gave belladonna and also found where Hahnemann gave belladonna and found that it also worked prophylactically. 3 years later, there was another outbreak of scarlet fever, and as I know you're well aware, the genus epidemicus in the subsequent outbreak was no longer belladonna; it was actually aconite. So the individuality. Yeah, it actually changed.
Yeah.
So my specific question was, like, for example, some people believe in homeopathic prophylaxis where, like, let's say you're going to India and, you know, there may be a risk of you getting, you know, a particular disease, so they'll give you the Nozode or maybe a common remedy for that disease prior to going there as a prophylactic.
Right.
I'm curious what your opinion was about that and if you had ascertained if there was any evidence in the literature of it being effective.
Right. I don't know. Basically, I'd say it's hit or miss. It's based on the susceptibility. So, like, for example, malaria has got, you know, what I've determined is that phosphorus, arsenicum, natmur, and China sulf, or China, can act prophylactically for malaria. But you don't know which one is going to work in any particular individual. So the recommended protocol is the first week take phosphorus, next week take arsenicum, next week take natmur, the third week take China, or fourth week, and then depending, the individual asks them to see which one of those weeks they actually felt better in themselves. Mm-hmm. And then that will, you know, any remedy that helps the individual be healthier is going to, of course, act prophylactically to any disease. Right?
Sure.
So, It would work, the genus epidemicus works is after the fact. Once you've had an epidemic and you start seeing cases and you start saying, okay, this is the remedy that's coming up, then you give it, and if those individuals are part of the collective, then it's truly the similimum for that. And I had one other piece for that, because it's known that the cholera epidemics that Hahnemann was treating were, the epidemicus was cuprum, camphor, or veratrum album. And I happened to be studying the French Revolution last year with my daughter and came across or just had an in-depth look at, you know, the fall from social position, which we see as symptom for veratrum, the militant dictatorship under Napoleon, we see cuprum, the horrible, ghastly sights that people were looking at with all the people being killed with the guillotines and blood just draining down the street. It's all representative of camphor. So those remedies came at that time during that epidemic, because that was the external situation calling upon that. You know, the wealthy were becoming paupers, and the kings were, you know, sent to prison, and all these show the fall from grace. It's a Veratrum story, right? So I don't know if we get another epidemic of cholera somewhere, if those three remedies are going to be indicated the same way.
I love what you just said, Kate. That was great. I'm a history buff, and I just love the comparisons you made for those three remedies to the historical events occurring during the French Revolution. It's just fabulous.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, well, there's a great dissertation on that in the chapter of cholera. It's,
fantastic. Yeah, that's great. So, Kate, just getting back to the actual mechanism of vaccinations itself, could you tell us a little bit about exactly what happens when you get vaccinated? How does it actually affect the immune system? What actually goes on?
Yeah. Well, so there's a couple different pieces here. One is the rate of development of the immune system. Okay, so we're learning now that the immune system actually takes a full 10 to 12 years to develop, and that there's different aspects that are prevalent at birth, and slowly over the next few years, other aspects develop. And what it is, it's the sophistication of the specific antibody producing, like the intelligence of that part of the immune system that takes so much time to develop. And typically speaking, in the first year, year and a half of life, infants only are capable of producing what we call a generalized immune system response, which is the ability to produce fevers, ability to localize, produce pus, discharge, something to a diarrhea, something to eliminate a pathogen from the body, and that the specific antibodies that infants need to adapt in their environment are acquired through nursing, through the breast milk of the mother. And slowly, as the immune system starts to develop, there are certain disease agents that the immune system can handle and has the ability to develop appropriate immune system function, get the fever, and then the specific antibody to liberate the, get the antigen out of the body, right?
Right.
And typically, these different stages of the development of the immune system mark different susceptibilities to different diseases. Like these childhood eruptive diseases, if an infant under 3 years old is exposed to them, they usually have a very mild case. And more often than not, nothing really happens. And they'll actually end up needing to get the disease later to get full immunity. That actually between the ages of 5 and 8 is the best time to get measles or chickenpox. Then the immune system can fully kick in and liberate the body from this disease. And actually, according to anthroposophical thought and even in homeopathic thought, that this process is not just a liberation of the disease itself, but it's also a liberation of inherited miasms, inherited tendencies that the child has from the genetics of the parents, and that these diseases offer an opportunity for the child's health to be liberated from those past encumbrances. Okay, so back to then the immune system, right? So what happens when you have natural exposure to disease? So usually disease comes against our skin, or is breathed in through our mouth, nose, into our lungs, and the first receptors of disease are, you know, the white blood cells that live on the surface and line our mucous membranes, and these white blood cells stimulate or call to alert the deeper aspects of the immune system that there's a foreign agent coming, and prepare the deeper aspects of the immune system to actually to come awake and get their white blood cells in order and to start looking for the pathogen and then make the specific antibody so that they can disarm them. And what happens to any individual who's vaccinated, the act of vaccination, of injecting the foreign particles directly into the bloodstream, it bypasses all these external layers. And so the immune system is just kind of ho-humming along before they realize that there's something foreign in there. And then it starts going, okay, well, oh, God, you know, maybe we should have had an allergic response happening. And then so you can get fevers and you can get other things like this, and then specific antibodies get made, but it's kind of confused and not necessarily all orchestrated in order like it would be as if it's natural exposure. Now, what happens when you introduce a disease directly into an infant's immune system that's not even capable of developing the specific antibody response? Well, what we start to see are localized inflammations, agitation, and a whole sort of systemic level as the immune system is trying to grapple with what we have. More often than not, you start to see ear infections, or inflammation of the middle ear is more appropriate. It's one attempt of the body to localize in one area this foreign matter near an orifice so the body can actually extrude it, and because there isn't the means to develop the appropriate antibody response. So maybe after the first vaccine, that's what happens. And then in conventional treatment, the child gets treated with antibiotics. And so the fever and this eliminatory process gets thwarted, because it's not actually even really an infection that's happening. And then the antibiotics go away, they're done with their treatment, and then after a few weeks, the body starts getting a little more strength, and it's like, okay, maybe I'll produce another fever. and we'll try to get this thing out of the body, and then, you know, more antibiotics are given, and this cycle can go on for months. And then maybe it's a good thing to actually put tubes in the ears, because then all of a sudden you've opened up the pathway for the body to eliminate what's going on. But during this time, then usually more vaccinations are given, and they kind of up the amount of vaccinations, and the most difficult vaccine for the immune system to reconcile with the two that I've come to see is the DPT and the MMR, which is at 15 months. And if the child has a greater susceptibility or like a more weakened state of ill health, then this is where you start to see the beginnings of autistic or other behavior like that. And the reason why the MMR, well, these two shots, I'll talk about them differently. The MMR is those exanthematic diseases, the measles and German measles, not so much the mumps, that one doesn't affect so much, but with the failure to produce external eruptions, the disease drives in deeper. It either goes to the digestive tract or to the nervous system. And this failure of the body to liberate itself will result in the symptoms that we start to see of head banging and, you know, moaning and cognitive dysfunction and all these different things. And it's partly the mode of vaccination that we talked about, but it's also the nature of the diseases in these particular vaccines that produce that, because that's, yeah. So, and the DBT also is the diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus. It's all the toxins of those diseases, and they are all neurological toxins. And so you're basically introducing those toxins, and the symptoms you see from those vaccines are high-pitched screaming and what apophthegms, which is the inflammation of the meninges of the spinal cord, some kind of arching backwards or boring of the head in the pillow or different symptoms like that. So, again, it's related to a partial expression of the disease. Yeah.
Kate, many years ago, Richard Moskowitz published a small little pamphlet on vaccinations. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but he made a similar argument about the danger of these various vaccine substances going in and not having an avenue for getting back out of the body. And because of that, he said he made the argument that the only really a fairly safe vaccine matter was oral polio, because there was still a route. And do you agree with that?
I would agree with that, and also the tetanus shot, because the exposure to tetanus is through a puncture wound. I think even though I've seen cases of like meningitis after tetanus and stuff like that, but as far as the effect on the immune system through that bypassing of the superficial layers, those two have the least amount of impact.
And also, Kate, you mentioned mercury. I know that they were, at least they were adding mercury to these products. Is that also, because I thought I was under the impression that that's now no longer the case. Do you know? Are they still adding mercury?
Yeah. Different states have different things going on here. In Minnesota, again, the Natural Health Coalition has lobbied the legislature to have that the number one vaccines available be mercury-free, and if there isn't mercury-free vaccines, you know, then to use the other ones. But it's not just the mercury that's in the vaccinations. And the thing of it is mercury is, you know, everybody's casting the blame of vaccine injury to be on mercury. And that if we just remove the mercury from the vaccines, then that's the problem solved. But you can see just from the few little things that I talked about here, there's a whole other realm that isn't even addressed with that idea of the mercury, right? But there's more than that. There's, you know, other heavy metals. There's formaldehyde. There's, what's that called? What do they make? Caulk out of? Latex, right? There's egg products. Some vaccines are developed on aborted human fetus tissue. There's many other things in the vaccine designed to produce an agitation in the immune system. In addition to the live or killed or cell or membrane of whatever the vaccine, the disease is. So these themselves, I mean, we don't even know what they are, you know, what the ramifications of all the, that presence is.
Right.
Yes.
Also, Kate, you mentioned autism. What's the relationship between autism and vaccinations?
Well, so autism is a syndrome, right, as opposed to a disease.
Right.
It's a compilation of symptoms that they've put. There's mental, emotional, cognitive, behavioral, and they don't necessarily bring into some of the physical symptoms that often come with autism, that such as a real hyper allergic to food, specific foods, food preservatives, dyes, you know, a lot of allergy to wheat and dairy and things like that, which actually, I just want to jump back one other thing. So all these byproducts that they put in the vaccinations, it causes this heightened level of allergic response, and then also the idea of injecting something foreign in before the immune system knows that there's something in there, it stimulates an allergic response. So what you see, like childhood allergies and asthma and skin symptoms and all of these are related to vaccine damage too. So they may or may not come with kids who are in the autistic spectrum, they call that, but they're also part of the picture. And the autism, those cognitive, I mean, I really think it's a compilation of everything. It's hard to sort out what comes first, what comes last. And it's only through treatment after the fact, after you see improvement from specific remedies, which you know those remedies relate to suppressed exanthema or ailments from being puncture wound, or was it the inherited condition of the individual? You know, based on the remedies that are given, then you can start to see, okay, well, this child had autism because of these factors, and this child had autism because of these factors, as you sort of unwind the case.
Yeah? Interesting. And relative to the autism?
What are you asking?
Yeah, I mean, so there is a strong relationship then in general between autistic syndrome and vaccinations,
yeah,
is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And even the CDC is, they've been skirting around this issue for so long, and there's you know, a class action lawsuit that's going on in New Jersey where they've got some 4,500 vaccine-injured kids, that it's like a year-long trial where, you know, Merck and all these pharmaceutical companies have failed to procure any studies or research linking autism and vaccinations. But so this class action suit is at least going to see if there's a legal violation that's been obscured here by, you know, keeping injecting people's children when they, against their will or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, scientific community.
Can you tell us a little bit about that class action lawsuit?
You know, I don't know all the details. I do know that I sent three books, to one to expert witness, one to the lawyer, and one to somebody who's sitting on the, there's three judges sitting on the bench, and hoping that they might glean some information from my book that helps them come up with the right decision here, you know, with enough evidence. I mean, clearly, one senator is quoted to say that this has been a silent battle fought by mothers who nobody listens to, and it was only until his own son, he's a senator of Ohio, only until his grandson developed autism after 15 months of age, he started to recognize the problem, and he's like, something's got to be done. Yeah. There's so much more that's not on the surface yet with this whole story.
Interesting. So Kate, as homeopaths, as the homeopathic community, what kind of alternative can homeopathy offer to vaccinations?
Yep. So we talked about that a little more, earlier, but firstly, I would suggest everybody gets treated with homeopathy to help reduce their susceptibility. And in the face of reduced susceptibility, we have greater health. And if infectious disease is to come along, we can treat with homeopathy, and also that the person would be less susceptible to getting sick. And this, if you go back to the idea that epidemics come when there's some malattunement in large populations of people, and that there's something about the susceptibility of those people that gives them a proclivity towards a certain disease state, and the germ just shows up, like, oh, I'm glad you invited me in, So when you treat the susceptibility of large populations of people and actually improve it, then there's no room for disease germs to come along, because we're healthier.
Sure.
Yeah. And then,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, in the case of epidemics, because there really still are epidemics, there's huge epidemics. We don't see them in Western countries, but in countries, third world countries, a lot of epidemics are a resultant effect of poor political regimes, poor hygiene, poor nutrition, things like that, which again are an outward expression of the inner corruptions of the people who create those societies, which has to do with susceptibility. But, homeopathy has an avenue there to start treating the epidemics.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think that's really relevant because it's, of course, right now, we see epidemics in the developing world. But now we see also kind of disintegration of the global financial system, with the banking sector being in. And so, we could possibly see something where, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but comparable to what happened after the Italian banking industry in the 14th century collapsed and was followed by the Black Plague. We certainly could see those types of conditions arising in the First World,
Well, and even if you look at what we're bombarded with daily in the media, gas prices are going through the roof and people are working three jobs and this economic strain, and it's kind of like a virus. If you keep watching the TV, eventually it's going to go in and start making people behave in certain ways that is disease producing.
Sure.
So, and how it actually, shows up in a germ, we have yet to see what the germ is.
Right.
That's going to come. Yeah.
Right. Well, Kate, this was a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate all the information and different ideas, and the book sounds absolutely wonderful. It is currently available, is that correct? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
It's currently available. Yeah, there's a couple different things happening with it. It is available. It's a print-on-demand publishing company that's Trafford, and that's based out of Canada. I know you guys sell it. Major booksellers sell it. It's also getting translated into German right now. It should have an edition out in German in September or October. And let's see. Yeah, I'm looking for a Spanish translator if anybody's willing to jump forward on that one.
When we open up the lines, maybe somebody will volunteer this week. Great.
Yeah.
So this is very, very exciting, and I want to personally thank you for taking the time to write such a book. It sounds it sounds exactly what we need. I'm going to go ahead now and mute out the lines and let some other people ask some questions.
Okay.
And let me go ahead and do that. So can people hear me?
Yeah.
Great. So does anybody have any questions for Kate Bush?
Title of the book first. What's the title?
The title is a very long title, Vaccine-Free Prevention and Treatment of Infectious Contagious Disease with Homeopathy.
Oh, it's very long.
Yeah, it's got everything in it, though. You know, I had to have every word in there. I sat there for 3 months rearranging those words to get them in the right order.
Yeah. Krishna, if you check your email, you'll see that the title of the book is in the email that we sent to you, so you can just find it
All
there.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
I have a question.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Go ahead, please.
I need clarification. I didn't hear who Markowitz's first name was.
Richard Moskowitz.
Oh, Moskowitz. Okay. And what were the two diseases that you said were okay to go in as vaccines? Tetanus and what other one?
The oral polio one, but that one is banned in the United States because actually the truth is, because it's a live vaccine, the virus gets shed in the stools. So those exposed to the stools of the person who's been, have the risk of getting the disease. The
book is $40.
Hey, Kate, are you aware of Dr. Grimmer's polio vaccination?
Just came out, so I don't think.
No.
Are you aware that Dr. Grimmer used the remedy Letyris sativa in over 25,000 children?
Oh, yes, for polio, yep. That was used in many epidemics very successfully.
It's in my book called The Collected Works of Arthur Hale Grimmer.
Yep.
Just so everybody knows, that's a remedy prepared from chickpeas.
Yeah,
well, not the chickpeas that we eat. It's a toxic variety of chickpea.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have to say
other questions for Kate Birch.
You have information on vaccines that were done 50 years ago.
You're asking me what about vaccines that were done 50 years ago?
Yeah, do you have information in the book on old vaccines and the progress of vaccines and what vaccines were given to people 50 years ago? I mean, do you have information for people that have been vaccinated 50 years ago?
Right, so you're asking whether homeopathy can treat sequelae of vaccinations from 50 years ago?
Well, I know it can.
Yeah.
But I just wondered if in your book you have information about the types of vaccines that were given 50 years ago versus what's given now.
I think it's basically the same vaccines, you know, and you treat according to the susceptibility of the individual. Now, many of us were given many vaccinations, but only one or two of them created a problem, or if they created any problem. And also, 50 years ago, this is one of the pieces that is different than now. Is most of us were lined up when we were already in primary school. It means our immune system's already fully developed. That most of the vaccine injury occurs because it's given to infants' immune systems that aren't capable of comprehending how to eliminate. And then plus also that they've increased just from the 5 or 6 vaccinations that were given 50 years ago to the 12 or 15 or however many different disease agents that they're vaccinating against now. Yeah.
Well, I was too young to remember when it was given to me, but... I guess that would make a big difference if it wasn't when you were first born.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I have an example, Kate, about that. I was vaccinated like 50 years ago in Mexico for tuberculosis.
Okay.
And I still react. Like if they try to put me the test.
Yeah.
I still react. I had the BCG.
Yeah.
And it's been 50 years ago, and all my children have, like, the tubercular miasma, and I think it's because of that vaccine. Could that happen?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I noticed. Well, my grandfather died of tuberculosis. Well, no, he had it. He died of emphysema much later, but... I reacted positive to the tuberculin test and also had received the BCG vaccine myself. And my son, even though he didn't express tubercular or he hadn't, a tubercular remedy hadn't been indicated for him until after he received the skin prick. And all of a sudden then he went into a full-on tubercular state. Now, whether it was from the skin prick or whether that skin prick just awoke in him this latent tubercular miasm that was, you know, inherited through his lineage is debatable. We don't know that. But, yeah.
Kate, in either in your personal practice or in your researches about vaccinations, have you found that there are certain remedies that are very commonly indicated for problems arising from vaccination? And also, do you find that it matters which disease you're being vaccinated for? In other words, like smallpox versus polio versus DPT, et cetera, and also which remedies, could you give us some ideas if there are some,
yeah,
which remedies you find there?
Right. Well, I had a really wonderful case of true vaccinosis. That's the state of chronic ill health as a result and effect of smallpox. She was given smallpox when she was 5 or 6 years old, and she came to me in her late 50s, and she had suffered chronic allergies and acne and headaches and things like that, which are the classic signs of vaccinosis. And in the first visit, I gave her Thuja, first a 30C, and she, and then we went up to 200, and maybe she had a 1M, but in a short amount of time, this 50 years of sickness that she had been carrying around with her just cleared right up, and she recalled going back to being like this happy child she was prior to getting vaccinated. Now, that's a beautiful classic case we see. Now, common remedies. So when somebody comes into the, you know, you take the case and there's all these different layers and then you've got the symptom picture. And what I see is it's a process of liberation. It's a process of eliciting a response from the body. So usually the body can't keep all the symptoms out on the surface all the time. It takes too much energy for the vital force to do that. So there are some states of disease that malinger deeper inside, but that if the vital force has been given a remedy or two, then there's enough energy to roust an immune system response. So what I usually see in the first month or two of treatment is a fever coming. And then the fever can often go into a stramonium, which is an suppressed exanthematic condition, or other remedies like carcinosin, which is fevers of unknown origin, different mixed disease states. Zinc is another one for the suppressed exanthema. Silica I've seen often, which is just the ailments from the puncture wound and the immune system unable to rouse sufficient energy. So anyways, after the first remedy or two given in the case taking, we get these acute conditions that rise up. And then through, sometimes they need a particular remedy for that time, or sometimes we just wait and see what happens and see how it resolves. And as the immune system gets stronger, you know, new layers come forth, that the immune system digs deeper and rouses more out of what's laying in the murk, you know, and pulls it up and shows it so that you can see when you're taking the case and give a remedy. So I've also seen like chamomilla and, you know, many miasmatic remedies, metirinum or tuberculinum, natrium muriaticum is cured almost a state of mental retardation from vaccine injury. I mean, they're very common remedies. It's not that we need to find something exotic, or if you understand the diseases and you understand what their partial expression looks like, and then you get to see which vaccines actually made the damage or made the imprint, then just looking for remedies that treat those diseases whether you're only seeing a part of the picture of the disease or not, that's going to be the way to go.
Great.
Yeah.
MR.
Other questions? Other questions for Kate?
Yeah, hi.
I do have a question.
It's just, if I could.
Hello? My son was actually given the MMR vaccination in February, and within 3 days, he developed a fever of over 105. He became lethargic. He stopped babbling. He stopped talking. I felt like I was on a TV show. You just saw all the signs coming out. And we, 5 days into it, we were trying different remedies, and finally we gave him the MMR remedy. Mm-hmm. And within 2 hours of giving the MMR remedy, his labored breathing stopped, his mottled skin cleared up, he started becoming interested in everything around him, started walking again, started talking again, started responding to his name. It was quite incredible.
Yeah.
And everyone around said if they didn't see it, they wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah. That sounds great.
Very thankful.
Now, I do have a question concerning the Thuja.
Yeah.
I had read an article, and this particular homeopath had said that he always, whenever there was any kind of vaccination, would always follow it up with a Thuja 1M, and that would antidote any excessive toxicity that could possibly arise and restore the immune system. Have you found that to be preventative?
You know, I thought a lot about Thuja when I was writing my book, and I think that Thuja predominated people's minds because of its relationship to the smallpox vaccine. And seeing as they stopped giving the smallpox vaccine in the 60s, the children these days, so far I've only seen one child that I gave Thuja to, and maybe it was a toxicity of why she needed that. I'm not sure if that's what it is. But I would say that Thuja does relate to that, saying as it's a tree that grows in the swamp and has to do with, you know, poor oxygenation of the water and stuff like that. But, I would say in older cases or those who've had exposure to smallpox or the parents have had smallpox, then yes, Thuja would definitely be indicated. But it's not necessarily so much as, you know, we just see it throughout all the homeopathic literature. I'll give Thuja all the time, but I don't think it's quite right.
Is there any remedy in particular that you would give after a vaccine?
Well, again, it's, you know, the classical approach is what's the reaction? I would be more apt to give silica sort of by rote or carcinosin. Those two remedies these days.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, Kate, what about if do you ever sometimes like give a Lidum right after vaccination to prevent any potential problems?
Yeah, it could be, and it would be particularly great like after a tetanus vaccine, right?
Right.
But it depends if it's an influenzinum shot or influenza. You know, maybe Gelsimium is better to give right away, or Arsenicum,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, good. A couple more questions?
I have a question about, Kate, whether or not you do phone diagnosis, since I live so far away. Do you work
well,
with
I don't
people?
Do diagnosis as part of being a homeopath and not a licensed practitioner, but I do phone consults, yes.
And how would I get your phone number for that?
Is my contact information on the website, Kim?
It might be. You could give it out now again if you want to.
Yeah, well, I'm also listed with the North American Society of Homeopaths. And so I'm in Minneapolis, and my direct number is 612-701-0629.
Thank you.
Yep.
I think we have time for one more question.
Can you tell me the Gelsimium arsenal when you give for those vaccines?
The dosing of auto vaccines?
No, Gelsimium and arsenal you give before, you know, after some vaccination. Which are those?
Oh, the flu.
Flu, okay.
Could you repeat your phone number? 612 what?
701-0629.
That's your direct number?
Yes.
Thank you.
We have time for one more question. Somebody have an interesting question for Kate that they'd like to ask?
Do you address animals in your book, since there's an abundance of vaccinating our pets?
The only chapter that's at all related to animals is rabies, but it's how it manifests in humans. So, no, somebody else, a vet, needs to write the same book for the animals.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, Kate, this was a very informative, very wonderful discussion. We really appreciate having you on. Maybe you'll come back and join us for a future teleconference interview.
Yep.
And, we'd love to have you back. And
yep.
Can we give Kate a big, warm thank you for joining us today?
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.